Accession number 9424, Reel 5.
Mr. Cooper, Reel 5. We were talking about the wiring party, in particular the one that was fired upon by machine guns and when two of your fellows were killed. What was your reaction to their deaths?
Well, not the same reaction that I would feel to a death now, because you're expecting it. I was sad that it was Captain Meadows, because I'd found in a short time had met him, he'd been so pleasant and considerate, etc. And the sergeant, of course, I couldn't recollect which sergeant it was, so I can't say I felt a great deal about that. I don't think any of us felt a great reaction if somebody was killed.
Do you recall being afraid when the machine gun was firing? Were you aware that the bullets were so close to you?
Oh, well, you're always afraid, yes. And yet, as I've said before, it's never going to happen to you. Yes, you were afraid, and directly I heard the very, pop go, well, down you went or stood still, and you just hoped to goodness that you weren't going to be caught.
Could you hear the machine gun bullets approaching when it traversed?
No, you can't. You can only hear machine gun bullets, really, when they're striking something. But if they're going over your head, you can't really, there's no perceptible noise. If you're a long way, for instance, if it's a long-range machine gun and the bullet is losing its momentum, it's a spent bullet, then you can hear it going to those puffing noise. No, otherwise, you hear the machine gun fire, but you don't hear the bullets.
Right, if we could move on to any other duties they did. I believe you said that you were involved in a burial party at one point.
Oh, yes, that was the captain of the company came to our post and said, oh, I want two men to go and bury, he said, I think there's a horse or a cow and one or two bodies in Ries de Vinage, they're smelling like hell, he said, go and bury them. So we went out about, well, it was not very long before dawn. We were fairly well concealed, you see, there were houses and trees around, and the first chap we came across was a young chap lying there, jet black. Not a coloured man, they go black, you know, and he was machine gun coy, probably been there since April, and this was about May, I suppose. And we had to got him there to the shell and levered him into the shell hole, and he went in it and like a sort of rubber ball, he was so bloated, and the back of his head fell off and it was full of maggots and the stench was simply terrible. And we got him buried. Then we tried to bury a horse, but we didn't get buried. Then we saw dawn coming, and then it was that Captain Meadows came and said, look here, you chap. He said, dawn's coming. He said, you better get back to your companies. And we went back to the company, and the captain was there. He said, who the hell told you to come back? And he said, Captain Meadows. He said, well, next time you go back to Captain Meadows and tell him you stay there till you finish the job. And we went back, and we never got the horse buried, but we buried one or two other chaps that were lying there. And I remember this chap from the machine gun corps, we felt in his breast pocket and took out some letters and fountain pen, etc. And I read one of the letters, which was rather pathetic, and it was from his sweetheart, and saying, I'm longing to see you on your next leave and always thinking of you. Try and come soon, your loving sweetheart, so-and-so, you see. And that was when I saw this great bouncing black ball and thinking, oh, that's the chap she loves. So it was quite a feeling of revulsion, really.
Did you, when you were burying these corpses that had been obviously rotting for some time, did you take any precautions?
We took their identity disc off, yes. Because everyone wore an identity disc. And it had two things on. You took one off and left one on. Because the burial party would have one and the other one you'd take back to your officer.
I was going to ask, did you take any precaution about covering your face at all to avoid infection?
Well, I put my gas mask on with just the nose. It couldn't work in it, but I just had the nose clip on. And for the rest of the day, this awful stench was... Yeah, I could breathe it all day, although I wasn't near it. Yes.
Were there many dead bodies lying around because they just couldn't be collected because of the danger actually reaching them?
Well, there were some, but not a lot, because in that first attack where there were a lot, you see, we weren't in that area again because we'd
this is at Ries de Vinage.
Ries de Vinage. But I know there were bodies lying around there because, as we discovered very much later. But for instance, when there was a raid and somebody was killed, well, one or two went down and brought the body in, and it was taken down to the canal and for burying in the nearest cemetery. But we never had a job of collecting bodies in. I don't know whether there was any special salvage party that did that. We'd just never heard.
Could you tell me what a salvage party was?
Well, after an attack, of course, a lot of men, you know, especially if they're retired, they dump things. A Lewis gun, I know myself, I had two heavy Lewis gun panniers over my shoulders, and when we were just avoiding the enemy and being sniped at, I just dumped them. And, of course, a lot of men, when they were wounded, their rifle was dumped, and ammunition pouches and so on and so forth. Lying out. Well, that's in particular after the April the 18th attack. Well, I think the night after that, they gathered the salvage party together, and we had to go up practically to the front line and pick up. There were dumped spades, pickaxes, bandoliers of ammunition, Lewis gun magazines, rifles, bayonets, etc., etc., and they all had to be collected, you see, and taken down the line to first of all battalion headquarters, and then what would happen to them then? I suppose they'd all be collected together and reissued, you see, down at the base.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you were actually in that salvage party, could you describe what the scene was like after that battle?
Well, yes, you couldn't see off. You could just see the things lying on the ground, and of course some dead men lying there, just like humps, and with cloth caps, steel helmets and things lying around to be picked up. And it's surprising the things we did fire, there's quite a load to take back.
All just everyday equipment.
Everyday equipment, rifles and bandoliers of equipment, Lewis gun magazines, spades, etc., etc.
Okay, thank you. Can we turn now perhaps to another aspect of the conditions in the trenches and look at the rations? You've already talked about bringing up the rations. What were what was the food like in the trenches?
Well, before I went out to France, I imagine that you just lived on bully beef and water and hard biscuits. Well, it was better than that, but the rations were very small. And it was always, now for instance, as regards the bread, they had cauliflower loaves, I should think, not a big loaf, probably about 8 inches across in diameter, and they always heard that at the base where the bread was turned out, that there were two men, a loaf for every two men, for the day's ration. Well, actually, when we got it was nearly always four to a loaf, not two to a loaf. And so you can that quarter of a loaf had to last us for 24 hours. And then we'd have a McConaughey, that was a tin of stew, and there were generally...
How big was the tin?
About 6 inches across and about an inch and a half deep.
Was that enough for, that was for one person, was it?
No. Perhaps it left the base for one person, but we it was all four men to ours. It was just a few mouthfuls of the McConaughey. And then we had what they call pork and beans, very much like the tinned beans we have now. And the only piece of pork was about an inch square on the top. And that was about one tin between three or four men. And I do remember, particularly a chap, when some of them got their rations, or one or two, they were so hungry they'd eat the lot after 24 hours. And we got tea in a little bag, and we used to boil our mess tins, hang them on a bayonet in the trench, and the tea and sugar was in a little little cloth bag mixed together. And we'd boil the water, put this tea bag in, and we had ideal milk. Then again, sometimes no milk. Sometimes one tin of ideal milk between four men for the 24 hours. And we used to drink. We had our own mug and we used to drink, but we were quite short of water. We very seldom had a set thing for our tea three times a day, which would be about a mug full. We didn't have any spare water at all. And the water was brought up in petrol cans. It never tasted of petrol because they were well scoured out. And we'd have, I can't remember how much water we had, but I know we were always short of it. We never had sufficient water to satisfy our thirst.
Mm. You mentioned that you boil the water. What did you boil it on?
Oh, yes. What they had, well, I don't know whether you've ever heard of a Tommy cooker of methylated spirit and wax. Well, we didn't have that. We used to make our own. They used to supply candles in the ration, not for lighting. We used to cut a candle in half, wrap it in a piece of sandbag, put it in an empty bullet tin, and set a light to it, and there'd be a big flame. That was our cooker. That's what we used to put under the mess tin to boil our water.
Did it take a long time to boil?
It was about 5 or 10 minutes, that's all. It was quite a good thing, yes, but this candle wrapped in a piece of sandbag, the sandbag, of course, was the big wick, and quite a good flame. We did all our boiling of water by that means.
Did you try and get water from anywhere else?
No, there was nowhere to get it. I remember once we got some water. We got some water from... I think it was a well, but it tasted terrible. It was all musty. And of course, you weren't allowed to do that, really. And I also remember getting water from a beautiful, clear, crystal water in a shell hole to boil. And it was all right, but we were caught by the sergeant. And he said, "Don't you know that's an offence? You must never drink water." He said, "It might have mustard gas in it." And I said, "Well, I saw a frog swimming in it, and I thought, so it must be pretty well all right." And it was, but you weren't supposed to do that.
I think earlier on you mentioned that you could supplement your rations from the local gardens. Were you able to do that often?
No, in the summer. In the summer, yes, we did. We used to go out on these. If it was well screened from the enemy, for instance, actually in Ruiz de Vinage, where there were trees and little houses, etc., well, we knew when we were out of sight of the enemy, you see, and then we'd this didn't happen often. It was quite a long time before we discovered we could find potatoes and sometimes peas.
And was that all you found? There's no livestock or anything like that?
No livestock. No, nothing like that was left. When we first went up to Sensla Valley before the 18th of April, when the French were all leaving, etc., well, then one or two other chaps captured a few chickens and things, and much to the annoyance of the French civilians. And I never had a chicken, or never, but I know some of them did get one or two chickens. No, there was no chance at all of anything else. But you know, as you can imagine, to cook some potatoes and you're so short of rations and bread, well, it was a great feast.
Do you have any other special supplies like rum at all? Was that issued to you?
Rum was issued, but only before an attack. No, I think it was rum issued on other times, but I don't drink, and I would never have mine. God's given this. And cigarettes, of course, there was a ration of cigarettes. I didn't smoke, so somewhere else, I was like the other chaps had my ration of cigarettes.
Right. Perhaps we could move on then from that to looking at the health of the troops. So you said you were always hungry. Do you think that affected the troops in any particular way?
No, I was extremely healthy. I never had a cold, and I never felt unwell, and I was never sick in any way in the whole time. The only trouble I had was with an army boot. One of my heels festered a bit once. So, but otherwise, no. We were all extremely healthy, excepting when the big flu epidemic, of course, swept over France, 1918, about June. There were chaps going down the line on stretchers every day, three or four of them, and in our post in Packet Wood, the corporal got flu, and he was carried down. That was going on an awful lot of flu, and when we were out on rest, sleeping in a barn, and three or four chaps were taken, or sleeping next to one chap, and went down with flu to the aid post, as they call it. But I never got it. Although, yes, an awful lot got flu in that epidemic.
Were you able to make sure that you kept healthy by perhaps being able to keep dry or what have you?
You really never tried to keep dry particularly. I mean, I'd be in one of the little scooped out seats in the side of the trench, and it would be pouring with rain all day, and my trousers would be soaked through and the bottom and everything like that. I just let them dry. Never got a cold, never got bronchitis or coughs. And we never did any sort of exercise to try and keep the question of keeping fit just didn't enter your head. It just same as when you're a boy, you never think of how fit am I, what can I do to keep fit. It's only when you get older that you start these little niggling thoughts. No, I kept fit, perfectly fit, the whole time. Never had a cold or a cough, or never felt unwell even. The only trouble I had once was with a heel that was very sore and festering because of an army boot rubbing it.
Mm. Were there any washing facilities in the when you were in the front line?
None at all. No.
Did anyone attempt to wash at all, or did you just accept that those
conditions? No, it was understood. You didn't wash for 14 days until you went when you went back out of the line.
As many as 14?
Well, you see, there was the front line, support line, reserve line. It was often 14 days, the spell in the different trenches. And then you cleaned up after that.
Mm-hmm. What were the latrine arrangements in your sector when you first arrived?
Well, when I first arrived, just none. And how we used to get it, when we were in these little posts about 6 or 10 feet long and 4 or 5 feet deep, well, if you wanted to go to the latrine, just got a spade and put some sand on it and took your trousers down and sat over the spade. And you got then with the result, you just. At the same time, it was a bit difficult because at the same time you had the spade behind you, you had to use the other hand to hold a bully can to water into. And then you just threw them as far away from the post as you could with a flick of the spade. Mm-hmm. No, there were no facilities, whatever. Mm-hmm. That's the thing people don't think of, I think, that what did you do about. Going to latrines because it just went. But in the reserve line, after about 3 months, they had a little 10-foot sap cut in the trench and a bucket with a wooden lavatory seat on it and paper on a piece of string on a nail. So things were very civilised towards the end.
Was that true of the front lines that time?
No. There were no latrines in the front line. Just did the same old thing, throw it away.
Okay. What about all the cans and so on that must have accumulated from your rations? What happened to those?
Well, I suppose, thinking back, although I don't remember at the time, I suppose they used to be collected in a sack and sent down. But I can't honestly remember what happened to the bully cans and the McConaughey tins and the Ideal Milk tins. That must have been. They must have been collected. That is,
they weren't thrown out of the trench?
Not that I can remember. In fact, my mind seems to be quite blank on that.
Did you have lice wider in the line?
Oh, yes. You just had to... Well, the first experience I had of seeing lice was when we were at the camp in ETAPS, as we called it, and there were some blankets hanging over us at the wire, and the chap said, "Have you seen the lice?" I said, "No," and looked at these blankets, and you could see all these lice, all with the coal, they were sort of dormant, sticking all over the blanket, and I said to one of the old hands said to me, he said, "You won't be long before you've got them all over you." And within a week or two, we had them. Mind you, they weren't like fleas. They didn't bite you all the time. Just slightly okay. And they used to lay all their eggs on you and under the collar of the shirt. And every so often, we used to have what we call a chat-up. And take your shirt off. This was when you're in the reserve line. You couldn't do it in the front line in case there was an attack. And we used to just go around with between our thumbnails and crack all the eggs and take all the lice off. And very often you used to get a candle and run it under the collar and you'd hear the click, click, click of all the eggs bursting. And the lice would just used to kill between our finger and thumb and they just dropped down. We had plenty of those. We used to do the big lice sometimes. We used to call them camels if they were extra big. So I've got a camel here, a big, big browny one. But mostly they were a sort of translucent white, sort of milky colour, the younger ones. But they turned your collar up, and there'd be all eggs underneath, and you those were, and the shirt too, shirt, and you kill those with your thumb, and or run a candle under. Mm-hmm. And then within a few days, it was just the same.
Mm. Did you ever have your uniform changed?
Oh, yes. When we came out of the line, they used to have a real delousing. You used to take off all your clothes, which were shirt, pants, and vests, and uniform, and they were put in a bundle, probably with you put your name on, and then they were put in a big steam oven, like a big sort of tank on wheels, and with the steam that killed all the lice and eggs, of course. Then you had a shower, which was means of a perforated petrol tin above you, filled with water, and then you just have a wash down under that, and then step out and dry yourself. And as you went out the other side, you were thrown a new bundle of clothes,
not your
and
own.
Socks, of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
But within a week, you were just lousy again. But that wasn't a great discomfort or anything to endure about it, but we just took it all for granted. I suppose as people did hundreds of years ago, they all used to be lousy, I believe, even the king and queen.
Were there any other problems with vermin in the line?
No, no, I never knew of any other vermin except lice. I never had fleas.
Right, could we move to the sort of everyday experience of fighting? Yeah. Not a particular action, but what happened during your time serving in the front line?
Well, after that big attack on April the 18th, well, all we experienced, I personally experienced, was shelling, machine gunning. That was the main, and gas shells as well. Well, you hardly a night went by, but what you didn't have a strap of shelling for an hour or more, just on the trenches, and then of course all the ration party tracks, which of course the Germans had photographed. I suppose they're these little tracks that show on the photo, and they used to shell those tracks, and they used to shell round Blackfriars Bridge or wherever they thought there'd be transport or activity, and it might only have lasted for 10 minutes, and then perhaps an hour or so, and then another 10 minutes. But sometimes the in the support line and reserve line at night, you used to get shelling for, well, most of the night in spasms of about a quarter of an hour.
Could you tell me what it was like to be shelled?
Well, it was quite frightening, and because the noise of them coming towards you, see, with this shrieking drone and then the explosions and everything, well, you just cowered down or got as much down in the trench as far as you could, and hoping to goodness sake that it would stop. And then at last, when it did stop down, well, it was a big sigh of relief. But then perhaps half an hour later, it was here. Oh, he started again, and that would go on again. But not a lot of shelling during the day, very little shelling during the day. And also, German planes didn't come over and strafe our lines like we did to the Germans. Now, when we were in our lines, you'd see about 10 Bristol fighters coming from the back of us, right over our heads. And directly they got over the German lines, they had all the machine guns opening. But we didn't have that from the German, I think, because we then had air superiority. But I shouldn't have liked that.
Can you tell me if there were any parts of the line that were shelled more frequently than others?
Oh, yes, support and reserve line. The front line wasn't shelled. And if there was going to be, or in the middle of an attack, they'd probably... Well, I don't know, even then, if they'd shell the front line, they probably would for a time, yes, and draw their own troops back a bit from their front line so as they wouldn't shell their own troops. That's what the thing they used to do.
Is that why they wouldn't shell our front line, as it were?
Yes.
I see. Why did they concentrate on the reserves and support?
Well, I think by constant shelling of supports and reserves, they destroyed the morale of the troops. I mean, after all, if you have every night of avoiding explosions and death and chaps being killed, well, it destroys your morale, and then it lowered your resistance, I suppose, so that if there was an attack, you weren't in such good spirits as if you'd never had any shelling before. That's what I imagine it was for.
Did you see any evidence of troops who had been exposed to a lot of shelling having their morale destroyed?
No, not visible, no. Of course, they're a tough lot, the English, you know, or the British.
No cases of shell shock that you saw, anything like that?
Well, once when a particular post had been blown up and one man had his legs broken and one killed and the other wounded, well, then they were sort of shouting, take me out of here, take me out of here, and shaking and being taken down the line, yes. But not in general, just if there had been nobody particular killed in the trench or it hadn't gone on for a long time. Yes, I did see signs of it.
Were you in a situation where you were very close to shell bursts? I mean, you say you were too close.
Oh, yes. Oh, frequently. Feel the blast of hot air coming from the shell and the shell fragments whizzing over. Oh, yes, very close.
Okay.
But unless the shell fell into the trench where you were, you're pretty safe.
Well, what about mortar shelling or trench mortars in particular?
Well, fortunately, excepting that before that first attack on April the 18th, didn't have any mortar shelling where I was.
So it was mainly shells and machine gun fire.
Yes. The shells were from what we call field artillery. Those were about 18-pounders. And then they used to have a lot of the Germans 5.9s. And that was a pretty heavy shell, probably weighing about 60 pounds or so. But not any big shells like the 9.2s from the guns. Those were all for dumps and crossroads and... marshalling yards, etc. Not so much for the trenches.
Did you experience any shrapnel shelling?
No, but we did an awful lot of shrapnel shelling to the Germans. I haven't used to... Suddenly the guns from Mount Bernisher would crackle out, about 20 or 30 of them at the time, and the shells, and you'd see them bursting in the air, and then all the shrapnel was going down over the German posts. But the Germans didn't use shrapnel on us. I don't, well, not one.